It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the number of refugees coming to Wisconsin has dropped in the last couple of years. We'll look at the numbers and how federal policies are affecting the state. First, it's our look at the biggest stories of the week in national politics. Former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort is standing trial after being charged with financial crimes. President Trump is threatening a government shutdown if Congress fails to fund a border wall. And the president also slammed the Koch brothers and their political advocacy network on Twitter, calling them, quote, overrated and a total joke. Our question for you this week is, what do you think of this split between President Trump and two of the Republican Party's most influential donors? What impact do you see it having on the party? If you're a Republican voter, are you on board with President Trump's criticism of the Kochs? And whatever party you lean towards, how do you feel about the influence of wealthy donors in politics and political parties? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have this trial. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager. Talk about what he's on trial for.
Yes, Paul Manafort, who served at one point in time, although not the entire campaign, as President Trump's campaign manager, is on trial and accused of illegal lobbying. Basically, the government claims that he lobbied for a foreign government. And when you do that in the United States, you're required to disclose that that happened. And in order to keep it secret, the government also alleges that he laundered money and committed tax evasion, taking in potentially millions of dollars in payments from these foreign governments and using shell companies and properties to hide those payments so that the government wouldn't find the work that he was doing.
And the prosecution, I gather, has been trying to highlight a high-living lifestyle exhibited by Paul Manafort. The judge kind of put the kibosh on at least some of that, but what kind of things are they pointing at here?
They're pointing to Paul Manafort's expensive homes in multiple states, his cars, his clothes, the ways that he outfitted his homes. They're pointing to the type of expenses that someone can live off of whenever they're making millions of dollars working for a foreign government. And the judge said that his lavish lifestyle was not on trial, that they couldn't sort of dwell on this lavish spending that he was participating in, and instead focus on where crimes might have been committed in order to obtain that money.
Now, Manafort is not being tried in this trial for coordination with the Russian government, but he was charged as part of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. How does Manafort fit into the bigger picture here?
This is the first time that we've seen Mueller and his team go into the courthouse to try a case. And you're right, he's not been charged with colluding with the Russians, although the work that he is on trial for does have to do with Russians and Russian-backed influence in the Ukraine, but not in terms of influencing the U.S. elections in 2016. But these are the type of crimes that Mueller and his investigators found while investigating the campaign and their ties to Russia, and that's why they've moved forward with this prosecution. These things are tied together, and President Trump has often tried to make the case that they're unrelated, that the work was all done before by Manafort, that he's accused of wrongdoing, was done before he worked for the Trump campaign. But there's a lot of figures that are the same here. There's a lot of folks that say that these ties that Manafort had is what contributed to the issues during the election season, and that's why we see sort of the intertwined nature of these two things.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters about some of the week's top national news in politics. President Trump tweeted about the Manafort trial. He tweeted a lot over the last couple of days. This one, quote, looking back on history, who was treated worse, Alphonse Capone, legendary mob boss, killer, and public enemy number one, or Paul Manafort, political operative and Reagan Dole darling, now serving solitary confinement, although convicted of nothing? Where is the Russian collusion? So President Trump clearly paying attention to this trial.
That's right. We've seen a number of tweets from President Trump on this, including one this morning that raised a lot of eyebrows, in which the president tweeted that the investigation was a, quote, terrible situation, and that, quote, Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this. He went on to call it a rigged witch hunt quote, before it continues to stain our country any further. The White House has insisted today that that was not an order from President Trump for Jeff Sessions to make this investigation go away. More say a request, a suggestion, not a mandate. But we are already hearing from Democrats that they think this is further evidence Trump is trying to interfere with the investigation and even interfere with the trial today through these public comments.
I want to move on now to another issue. We'll keep watching this trial as it unfolds. Yesterday, President Trump targeted Charles and David Koch, owners of Koch Industries, a large political advocacy network under their direction. What did he have to say about them?
President Trump, also using his favorite tool, Twitter, yesterday, blasted the Koch brothers, Charles and David, as you said, to what we could call mega Republican donors. They pumped millions and millions of dollars into elections trying to help Republican candidates. And he called them globalist and a total joke, said he didn't need their money, said that he had beat them at every turn. The Koch brothers didn't support President Trump when he ran for office in 2016. And they feel like they cannot support candidates that embrace the president's trade position. And as a result, the president didn't take too kindly to that and had those choice words.
Right. Specifically, it sounds like they've only said picked one candidate and said, hey, we're not supporting their Senate bid here, a Republican. But that's kind of a big deal. They have a lot of pull in Republican politics.
They have a lot of funds and a lot of resources on the ground. The Koch brothers operation, particularly through Americans for Prosperity, have a strong history of organizing voters, of doing the grassroots door knocking that can be very expensive. And without that support, that could be a real detriment to a candidate, particularly one who's challenging a sitting incumbent, which means they already have a little bit of an advantage. And in a race that nearly everyone thinks could be too close to call between Kramer and Heidi Heitkamp.
We invited your calls at 800-642-1234 on the president and the Koch brothers. Vern is with us in Stanley. Vern, hi.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on. Yeah, and these Koch brothers, they may finance a lot of campaigns, but I don't think it's legal for them to come out in public and say, if you don't continue trade as normal with communist China, we are not going to support you Republicans. They're actually trying to badger the president. I don't think it's actually legal.
Right, but you support the president on tariff issues, Vern, it sounds like?
On China, because
on China in particular.
They have stolen our technology, they have stolen our nuclear technology, and that's why our wages are so low. We cannot compete with China, and the other nations haven't done this to us, so we can work out deals with them. But now if we say buy $1 billion worth of stuff from China, they can take that billion and in their currency rate, they can make, say, $3 billion worth of weapon systems, and then we got to spend $9 billion to counteract that.
Vern, thanks a lot for calling in. So Republicans, I guess, will have to decide which side they're on here, Ginger.
That's right. And just to answer, I think that was maybe a bit of a question. There's very few rules that say that donors can't withhold or publicly announce that they're withholding their support in exchange for particular policy positions. There are rules that say you can't give campaign donations in exchange for, say, government contracts or something that will directly personally benefit you in a really direct way. But even just public policy that would benefit you, you're allowed to say, I'm not giving you money if you don't do what I want you to do on the policy front. And that's what the Koch brothers are saying, that they feel strongly that there should be free, unfettered trade and that anyone who's against it isn't going to get their campaign dollars.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, about the week's top political stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What impact do you think President Trump's split, at least for the moment, with the Koch brothers will have on the Republican Party? If you're a Republican yourself, do you agree with the president's criticism of the Kochs, or do you think that they're right to withhold funding for candidates based on tariff issues? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Ginger Gibson, a correspondent for Reuters. It's our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics. Ginger, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced this week that he was forming this Religious Liberty Task Force in the Justice Department. What's it going to do? What's the plan here?
Jeff Sessions, who has made a defense of what he calls religious liberty really central to his message, to his time as Attorney General, has created a task force that he says will be tasked with making sure that all decisions made inside the Justice Department are adhering to his views or protection of religious liberties. Jeff Sessions argues that there is a, quote, dangerous movement undetected by many that he says is, quote, challenging and eroding our great tradition of religious freedom. Critics of Jeff Sessions and of this task force say that it's really just an attempt to undo some of the protections and the rights that have been gained, particularly by LGBTQ, gay, lesbian Americans in the United States, and that in the name of religious freedom, they're trying to erode some of those protections that have been added.
So on a practical level, do we know what's going to happen, what this task force will do to go along with those principles?
So from what I understand, they'll look at sort of decisions that are being made in terms of who to prosecute and who to defend through this office, the language that's being used in court filings, and ensure that it's sticking with a previous memorandum or order that Jeff Sessions got. He's basically arguing that the Justice Department is just so big that he alone cannot keep tabs to make sure that they're all doing the thing that he wants and they're all adhering to the principle that he wants. So he's going to include a task force that's able to oversee a lot of this and make sure that that's being implemented.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters about some of the week's top news in national politics, we invited your calls about this, at least for the moment, split between President Trump and Charles and David Koch, prominent conservative donors. Scott is with us now in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi, great show. Calling from the Democratic perspective, I think what President Trump is doing to undermine the Republican Party is delightful from my perspective. I mean, it really shows the personality of this president. He's a bridge burner. He's not a bridge builder. Always has been. Always will be. And as we look at at the politics in Wisconsin and how Walker is behind the Democratic candidates, how Paul Ryan's timely retirement. He's destroying the GOP, and I couldn't be more happy about it, to be honest with you.
Scott, thanks for the call. Ginger, what do you think of Scott's read on the impact of this?
Scott is probably sharing the delight of many a Democrat across Washington who saw this news. I think that what we're seeing here is the continued internal division within the party. Some in the Republican Party thought once they had control of the White House and both chambers of Congress, that the divisions, the sort of what's often labeled a civil war for the last nearly 10 years now, would be remedied, that they would come together, that they would establishment and Tea Party find a way to work together. And what we're seeing is those divisions become even larger, that there are real policy difference between the two sides, and that it's more than just two sides that these divisions are opening up over, and that there's going to be real problems for them both governing and campaigning whenever sort of the party's establishment, the president, the person who holds the Oval Office, has such big disagreements with one of the largest sources of money for their candidates.
But it seems like when polled, Republican voters say we'll choose Trump over the rest of the Republican Party if and when they disagree.
That's right. We're seeing the Republican Party really becoming the party of Trump. And they're saying, yeah, I know you told us all this time we wanted free trade and then we wanted these other things. But Trump tells us we should want something else. And so we're on board with wanting something else. But there are still factions. And particularly when such key elements, even if the Koch brothers are just two individuals, but their donor network is larger. So even we're talking about a few dozen individuals or 100 individuals. There are 100 individuals who are writing checks. And they are needed in their party if they're going to continue to try to beat Democrats.
I want to turn to another issue that may further these divisions. During a press conference with the Italian prime minister this week, President Trump again floated the idea of a government shutdown if Congress fails to raise funding for border security. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Personally, if we don't get border security, after many, many years of talk within the United States, I would have no problem doing a shutdown. It's time we had proper border security.
And he's tweeted to back that up. What are Republicans making of this threat of a shutdown, Ginger?
Republicans in Washington want nothing less. They do not want to shut down. They view that as a huge political risk. If the president did shut the government down, it would be on October 1. We're talking about weeks before the midterm election. The president thinks it's a messaging war he can win. Even just the threat that he's telling his supporters, his base, that he is strong, that he will fight for them, and that he will get them what he wants. And if he doesn't get it, it's the Democrats' fault. And that's why he needs more Republicans in Washington. But Washington Republicans are very worried that voters will not buy into that argument, and they will look at a Washington controlled in the Congress and in the White House by Republicans and say, you couldn't even keep the lights on, guys. Why should we send you back for another 2 years if you can't do sort of the basic functions of paying the bills every year? And they want President Trump to back away from this argument. I don't know that it's going to work to get him to stop talking about it, at least until the very end. But we do know that he has threatened to shut down before and didn't go through with it. So they're hoping, I think, here in Washington, that it's mostly bluster and not a real threat to pull the trigger on a shutdown.
Very briefly, Ginger, once upon a time, a president repeatedly calling for a government shutdown would have been the top story of the probably month in August. There's so much other stuff going on. It's kind of, just one of many issues.
It is one of many issues. There's a Manafort trial. There's trade issues. There's tariffs. There's a shutdown. There's a wall. There's still the issue of children separation. It's been a very busy summer in Washington, will continue to be. And Republicans are hoping that there is some calm before the November elections, and Democrats are hoping that the chaos is perceived by the voters as a sign that they need some new blood here in Washington.
We'll leave it there. Ginger, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. She was getting us up to speed on some of the week's top stories in national politics. We talked earlier this year about how Wisconsin's refugee resettlement numbers changed from 2016 to 2017 and what affected that program. Our colleagues at WisContext decided to take a mid-year look at how 2018 is shaping up, and Scott Gordon joins us now to talk about it. He's associate editor of WisContext. Scott, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a sense of the numbers over the last few years. How many refugees have been coming to Wisconsin?
So we looked at basically the first half of each of the last 3 years. So this year, from January through June, there were 221 refugees resettled in the state. In 2017, that number was 443, and in 2016, during that same period, there were, almost 800 refugees resettled in Wisconsin. So it shows you a pretty steady decline.
A pretty big drop. Now, you write that over time, there's some natural up and down in refugee resettlement based on the need, what's going on in the world, right?
Right. I mean, it's something that's just inherently tied to sort of crisis and upheaval and, of course, presidential administrations have a lot of discretion to set kind of an overall goal for the number of refugees admitted. And obviously, where different people are end up settling will sort of change over time based on a whole host of other decisions. Of course, there's definitely going to be some ups and downs. But what I think what we're seeing here is definitely something that you could ascribe to the administration kind of cracking down on refugees and this and kind of their opposition to it to resettlement, essentially.
Right. This recent decline in refugees in Wisconsin is tracking, as you say, national policy, and it sounds like national numbers of refugee resettlement. Right. They're showing the same kind of pattern.
Yeah, and I mean it is really drastic because Obama in his final years in office set some pretty high targets for the number of refugees the United States would admit, partially in response to the crisis in Syria. and the Trump administration pretty much immediately sort of lowered their targets and obviously instituted a ban on entry from several countries where refugees come from and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, it is a big dramatic shift, and it does reflect a big change in policy.
Now, we've talked about the groups in Wisconsin that work with refugees being resettled here in the state, and you checked in with them as part of your reporting here. What are they saying about this decline in refugees and how that's affecting their work?
Well, it makes things difficult for them because of the way, in part because of the way the funding structure works. These nonprofit agencies really do a lot of the sort of on-the-ground work that needs to happen when somebody arrives in their new home, basically, to sort of get started, whether that's helping them find jobs or connect with services or, you know, rounding up donated furniture and housewares for them so they can get a good start. The federal government funds these agencies in part on sort of a per capita basis. So, money for each person settled. And if that becomes unsteady, then it's really hard for them to sometimes keep their doors open, to keep staff on, or to just kind of be prepared for the needs of whoever comes next.
So if, say, 2 years ago we had 800 people in 6 months, and I'm at one of these agencies, I need to quick hire some more people to help out with that, then I need to let them go if the number declines the next couple of years. And if there's a big rush again, I'm not ready. Is that kind of what we're seeing here?
Kind of, yeah. I had one program manager at Jewish Social Service of Madison tell me that kind of ironically, over the past year, they've dealt with more refugees just as an individual organization, even though numbers are down overall. But they're still in a situation where their resources are stretched and they're not sure that they could, say, hire another staff person and really be able to keep that person on full time, just given how unpredictable the situation is. So what we're really seeing is not just a drop in the numbers of refugees being resettled, but an effect that really kind of undermines and strains the broader infrastructure that supports these folks.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about his reporting on the latest numbers on refugee admissions here in Wisconsin. Scott, we've talked in the past about where in the world refugees are coming from when they come to Wisconsin. As you say, Syria is often the big story, but you've written in the past that people from Myanmar, or also known as Burma, have been coming to Wisconsin. Is that holding true in the latest numbers?
Yes. Even with this drastically declining overall picture, refugees from Burma continued to be the fastest growing resettled refugee group here in Wisconsin. And that is interesting on a lot of fronts because they don't seem to enjoy the same kind of visibility in the popular mind that some other refugee groups in the state do. And because the crisis in Burma has so many different fronts and there are basically so many different populations in different parts of the country that the government is persecuting.
Right. And there are various reasons people would want to leave that country. And we don't know from the numbers. We know if somebody came from Burma. We don't necessarily know from the numbers you looked at which of those often ethnic minorities in Burma they might be members of.
That's correct. So the data that you get from the State Department on a site called RapsNet, and this is sort of the basis for our story, we'll break things down by country of origin, but won't get into specific ethnic groups and whatnot. And so, of course, you can obviously talk to like the individual service agencies to see kind of what kinds of situations the people they're resettling are coming from to get somewhat of a better sense of that. But there are kind of multiple things happening in Burma. It's a country with many different ethnic groups and religious groups. And, even members of kind of the ethnic majority have fled as refugees because of, the government basically being a repressive government, more or less. That's nominally democratic now. But, yeah, it is hard to get a sense of that from those numbers themselves.
That's where they're coming from. What do we know about where refugees end up when they come to Wisconsin, as far as where in the state they end up?
Well, they're mostly coming to, bigger cities, which makes sense because there's just going to be more resources and more of a support network there. The vast majority of refugees resettling in Wisconsin still end up in Milwaukee. They also have the Fox Cities area, Oshkosh and Appleton and Fond du Lac and even Sheboygan, if you're stretching the definition, I guess, a bit, collectively resettle a lot of refugees, too. And of course, so does Madison. And you do see refugees resettling in smaller communities around the state. But it's generally those bigger ones where they'll be, closest to the agencies they're working with and closest to a support network.
We've talked to the director of the Fox Cities Refugee Resettlement Group just about all the needs that refugees have here in the country. I don't want to cover that ground again, but in checking in with these groups that work with refugees, do you get a sense that they're feeling like they can't keep up with those needs?
I think they're struggling to. Catholic Charities in Milwaukee has recently announced that they're going to stop doing their refugee resettlement work. So that leaves four of these nonprofits in the state that are actively doing it. No one else has told me yet that they're thinking of getting out of that work, but they're clearly expressing a lot of strain and a lot of frustration and a lot of uncertainty.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext. He shared a mid-year check-in on refugee resettlement in Wisconsin so far in 2018. You can read his piece on the topic at wiscontext.org. Foxconn broke ground on its factory in Mount Pleasant this summer. There are thousands of jobs expected at the facility. Some local officials are worried that people who need jobs in southeastern Wisconsin may not be able to get to them. Milwaukee's County Board of Supervisors tackled the issue with a proposal to create a new bus service connecting workers with Foxconn. Late last month, the board voted 16-1 to initiate discussions with Racine County, the state, and Foxconn about transportation for the company's future workers. Theodore Lipscomb Sr. is the chairman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. He introduced the proposal back in March. Chairman Lipscomb, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob. Appreciate the time.
Talk about your concerns. You've got all these jobs coming to southeastern Wisconsin. What are you worried about in terms of connecting people with those jobs?
Yeah, so if you look at where the site's located, obviously it's a regional opportunity, and there is some challenge, right, in moving workers. So even in Racine, where it's located, where people live is significantly away from that site, and so there's going to be a transportation problem, even for those who are closest to the site. But for me, I'm obviously most interested in Milwaukee workers being able to get access to some of those jobs, and that geographic gap is even larger. So we've got to figure out a way to get them there. Even if people had cars, do we really want them building parking lots for 13,000 workers? So mass transit should be part of the solution, and so that's why I floated an idea at the beginning of March, and still needs a lot of work, but we at least have the clear policy direction from the county board now that this is something that we're behind.
So what kind of plan do you have on the table right now?
Sure. So I had asked SewerPAC, which is the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, to model the potential of dedicated bus service. And they did that, and that's what I had first introduced in March. And that idea was, sort of looking at a variety of levels of service. So, should we run 4, 6, 8, 10 buses, that sort of thing. And what kind of route, what would the times be, how many people could be served. And that initial analysis is where, at the top, sort of at the top end, they said, well, if the demand's there, if people want to do it, want to take those rides, if even 10% of the jobs could be served by bus, that would be, then you're talking 1,300 people. That would be a great success. Obviously, if we could do better, if we could do even more, I'd be interested in that. But the idea would be to use dedicated service from both cities to the site.
And have you looked at how to pay for the new public transport connections to Foxconn?
Yeah, right. That's always the challenge. So you know, obviously our transit system, like others, is it struggles with declining or stagnant funding, and so that's always always part of the challenge. In this case, what I put on the table as a conversation starter was $4.5 million that are the proceeds from sale of some former Midwest Express facilities, and this was the result of the last time that the Racine and Milwaukee and the state partnered, which was in an attempt to save Midwest Express. During the downturn, we had we'd all put up some money as well as guaranteed these hangars. And unfortunately, that deal didn't work out. Obviously, Midwest Express didn't survive. And we were left with these hangars. And for a while, we were carrying them, unable to find buyers. But we did finally sell them last year. And there's $4.5 million in proceeds from that. And so the idea was, you know, just as we tried to, or did, partner on what was an important business and that had, you know, served both communities and the larger region, that in the same way, you know, that this is sort of the greatest opportunity in front of us today to do the same thing and partner on regional economic development and connecting our communities.
As I understand it, to tap into that money, the proceeds, as you say, from the sale of those hangars, it would take some negotiations between the counties, the state, I think the federal government, too.
So it's sort of in dispute as to who all the players are or what their roles are. And part of that is that the initial agreement never contemplated this happening. So the agreement contemplated, what if we never had to step in and spend the money that those communities had put up or use those funds? But we did. All those monies did get used. And we were still on the hook for even more. We had to borrow money in the end. And it never contemplated, well, then what if later, after it sort of doesn't work out, what if it then produces a surplus? And so in this case, it did. So this is we're in uncharted territory in that sense. And so it's in dispute as to who really has a claim. And so that's why I'm suggesting that the way to work that out is to negotiate it and to do it in a mutually beneficial way. Obviously, both communities, as well as the state, have an interest in getting workers to the site. And so I'm hoping that by sitting down, we can work through whatever the issues are and come up with an equitable way to fund it.
Talking to Theodore Lipscomb, chairman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. He's calling for a public transportation option to connect workers in Milwaukee and Racine with jobs at the new Foxconn plant to overcome possible transportation hurdles. Bigger picture, do you see Foxconn having potentially a big impact, employing a lot of people in Milwaukee County, Milwaukee City itself?
I do. I mean, there aren't enough people near the site to work there. They've got to draw from somewhere, and so I really do believe that there's an opportunity for a significant number of people in Milwaukee to work there. Obviously, I think that over time, you know, some people may move to the sort of the middle geography between there, and that's natural. But as of right now, to fill those jobs, they're going to have to draw from Milwaukee, and that's a positive for us, and we should be part of this.
On the flip side, are you worried about this maybe being a missed opportunity for workers in Milwaukee without things like a transportation option for people to get there? Are you worried that Milwaukee wouldn't see benefits?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why I'm really urging that we get to work on it now, and with the idea that while those jobs are not there yet, this really needs to be in place and be known so that people know that they have a reliable way to get there, and that they will, in fact, then apply for jobs. Because if you don't know, if you know that you have no way or no reliable way to get there, you're not applying. So you've got to have that part of the equation worked out. And so I really think the time is now to get to work on this. And we've had some encouraging initial reports from our transportation department just before it came to a vote this last month, and that was not the case back in March. I mean, at that time, no conversation had occurred.
Now, we have a statewide election going on. A majority of Democratic candidates for governor said they would work to rescind the Foxconn deal. The other couple said they'd want to renegotiate. Does that put your planning on hold in any way, the possibility that the deal potentially could be rescinded?
Yeah, so I won't put odds on whether the deal is rescinded or modified or whatnot. But you know, I'm going to work off the idea that some level of development of significant development and jobs are going to occur there. If somebody wants to rework the deal, that's beyond my responsibilities. But if they want to negotiate something else. Likewise, I would say, you know, within the state's commitment to this, if there are other sources of funds, I'm certainly open to that. I mean, if what I put on the table is the wrong pot of money, then let's talk about what are the other state sources or other sources that they want might make available. Because I certainly think that most people would agree that this is a good thing that we should be working on. That the transportation, you know, it doesn't stop at the county border. You know, people cross county lines for jobs, and we've got to figure these certain sorts of things out.
Are you also hopeful that there could be, and this might not be coming from the county itself, but hopeful that there could be job training that would help match people who currently don't have jobs but might not have the skills needed for Foxconn? Is that something you're looking for in the short or long term?
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely interested in that, and there's been some indication that some of the package that from the state includes job training. There was some reference to transportation, and I've just never really been able to get those sorts of details. So that's the kind of thing that I'm hoping that our administration and those other agencies can really sit down and hammer out.
Getting back to the transportation issue as we wrap up, what's the next step now? The board has advanced this plan, a lot of potential stakeholders here. What's the next step?
Yeah, so it's I should have asked the county exec this morning when we met whether he was signing this one. Presume that he would sign it. It obviously had near unanimous support from the county board, so the policy is clear that this is where the county wants us to go, and so hopefully those departments will be directed to undertake that work and you know, sit down and have those negotiations and bring something concrete back for approval.
We'll leave it there for now. Chairman Lipscomb, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again, Rob.
Theodore Lipscomb Sr. is chairman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. He joins today to talk about his proposal to create a bus route for future Foxconn workers in Racine and Milwaukee counties. He says there's a potential transportation gap that would keep people in areas that need jobs from applying for jobs at the new Foxconn facility. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts on Foxconn. Do you think the state, local governments should be investing in this kind of transportation infrastructure? How do you think the state should connect workers in the state, maybe in the areas with a little higher unemployment in southeastern Wisconsin, with these new jobs expected at Foxconn? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, email ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you think about planning for the arrival of Foxconn. Wisconsin cheese is in the news. So here's Dean Canetter, resident cheese guy. Dean, a lot of news this week in Wisconsin cheese.
Things are happening, Rob. This last weekend, the American Cheese Society wrapped up its annual competition. Wisconsin didn't win Best of Show, but it won 27 first place awards in different categories. That's as many as Vermont and California combined.
And that's first place awards. Didn't we get like upwards of 90 awards in various categories, first through third?
If you count first, second, and third, yeah, a lot
and
of
I
those.
Do.
Some highlights from there: Hidden Springs Farmstead Feta, Widmer's Aged Brick, Hook's You Have to Be Kidding Me won Best Mixed Milk Blue, and Landmark Creamery's Petit Nuage won Best Fresh Sheep's Milk Cheese. Really happy about that one. That's a really good cheese.
And then we talked a while back, the Wisconsin dairy people had a giant cheese board at that big South by Southwest in Austin. They're looking to do that one better now, going for Guinness record today.
That original cheese board in Texas got a lot of love on the internet, but as you said, this one is possibly going to be the world record holder. They're going to build a life-size barn in downtown Madison and build a cheese board that I think is 35 feet by 7 feet. It's going to hold over a ton of cheese.
Are you going to try to get down there and eat some of that cheese, Dean?
At least half of it.
At least half. Yeah. All right. Dean, thanks a lot. Always good to talk to you about cheese.
Thanks, Rob.
More to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.